You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I chatted with Dr. Danny Evans. Some of our previous interviews in this series revolved around anarchism, and this time I discussed the anarchist movement during the Civil War. We discussed the preparedness of the anarchist groups for the war, their reactions to the start of the conflict, and then many of the political developments that occurred within the Republican camp as the Civil War developed. One topic that we discussed that I think is worth reiterating here before the interview begins is that it can be easy to categorize people into certain political ideologies based on their self-categorization or due to the groups that they say that they belong to. However, when looking at historical individuals or movements or groups, it's far more important to look not at their statements or titles, but instead at their actions. This is true for communists, like we discuss in this interview, but also can be applied to many other groups at almost any time in history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm here with Dr. Danny Evans from Liverpool Hope University and the author of Revolution in the State, Anarchism in the Spanish Civil War. Dr. Evans, how are you doing today?
All right, thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. So we'll just jump right into the questions here. So when the Spanish Civil War started, how was the conflict viewed by anarchists? And more specifically, how did they view cooperation with the leadership of the Republic? My understanding is that there were some divisions within the Spanish anarchist movement about if the Republican government should be supported at all.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Wesley. I gather that you're going to be speaking to a friend of mine, Matt Kerry, at some point. And he knows a lot more about what I'm going to say than I do. But there was a very strong sentiment that had developed in the 1930s among anarchists and the wider left in Spain. And particularly in light of what was happening in Europe with the rise of Nazism and authoritarian right-wing regimes, that the left in Spain wasn't going to go down without a fight. And so members of anarchist or anarchist-influenced organizations, such as the Anarcho-Syndicalist Union, the CNT, made what preparations they could to face down the military coup. And then in the beginning of the Civil War, they enlisted in the tens of thousands for the militias that set out to try and recover the areas that had been lost to the military rising. So the anarchists viewed the military rising as a matter of life and death right from the get-go. And I think it's important to stress that because you occasionally see some quite flippant remarks about the anarchist supposed attitude towards the Civil War. But there was never any bones made about how existential this threat was to the anarchist movement. And they viewed it in those terms right from the beginning. On to the question of collaboration then. Given that the Republican authority dissolved in the face of the attempted coup, anarchists in the areas of Spain that had successfully resisted the rising formed a part of a series of ad hoc anti-fascist organizations alongside other forces on the left, defined broadly, you know, including some moderate Republicans. And the makeup of these anti-fascist committees tended to be based on the balance of forces that had existed in any in those areas prior to the rising, balance of forces within the left and the labor movement. Now, because the central Republican government had effectively disappeared from the picture at this point, the question of formal collaboration with the state, as opposed to simple participation in ad hoc committees, was first posed on the regional rather than the national level for the anarchist movement. And it was posed most dramatically and most importantly in Barcelona, where the anarchist movement was very strong and where the defense committees of the CNT had played the most significant role in the suppression of the military rising. And where also the defeat of the coup had very rapidly developed into a revolutionary situation. So during those tumultuous days, right, of a revolutionary situation in which the military rising has only just been suppressed and in which the CNT's, the level of the CNT's mobilization had been absolutely instrumental in putting the military rising down, a group of anarchists, leading anarchists, meet in Barcelona and discuss whether they should collaborate in a body that was called the Central Committee of Anti-Fascist Militias, which they decided that they would do. And this body, although it appeared on the face of it to be just one more ad hoc committee, ad hoc anti-fascist committee, was in fact formally subordinate right from the beginning to the Generalitat, which was the regional government of Catalonia. Anarchist collaboration in the central government doesn't come about until several months later, November 1936, under the premiership of the socialist Largo Caballero, when the central government, governmental authority of the Spanish Republic has been recovered, more or less. In the meantime, alternative proposals that the anarchist movement and specifically the CNT had put forward for a government by anti-fascist committee, which would have been dominated by the labor unions, have been dismissed. So at every stage of this process, some people within the anarchist movement, including in the quite restricted meeting that first decided on collaboration in Barcelona, had raised opposition to this question of formal collaboration with the state, right? Anarchism being a movement which by definition is against the state. But it's only really with the entrance of anarchists into government, into central government, and the enormous shock of seeing anarchist government ministers that a sort of concrete oppositional movement within Spanish anarchism began to crystallize.
Interesting. So did the relationship between those two groups evolve over time? Like the anarchists who were involved in the central government and those who were perhaps ideologically opposed to such actions, did that evolve over the course of the Civil War early on or even later on when, as the Civil War kind of evolved and started going poorly?
Yeah. So, the relationship evolves in different directions. It's important to note that although the anarchist movement had traditionally been defined by its sort of directly democratic internal functioning. So it had like the organizations such as the CNT had mechanisms to limit the sort of emergence of hierarchy within those organizations. So they were meant to like operate from a bottom up direction. And largely had done, you know, with some caveats in the years prior to the Civil War. But this democratic functioning was greatly disrupted by the war. So the debate about the role that the organization would play in Republican administration was largely played out among reduced circles of leading activists in the Republican rearguard, who were called higher committees, you know, to, as a sort of literal translation from what they're known as in Spanish. And in some ways, the Spanish Civil War and the Revolution presents the paradox of anarchist traditions of direct democracy becoming the basic organizing principle of certain workplaces, certain industries, and whole societies in the case of some towns and villages. particularly in rural areas. While the formal organizations of anarchism themselves became more hierarchical. So it's a paradox. From the winter of 1936, so as I mentioned, like following the CNT's formal entrance into central government, into 1937, you have a crystallization of an oppositional movement within Spanish anarchism. Discontent spreads among the middle ranks and the grassroots of the anarchist movement with regard to the direction that the leadership was taking. And this began to find organizational expression. You have like new newspapers appearing, new affinity groups being formed, particular centers of opposition, such as branches of the libertarian youth organizations, also the anarchist women's organization, Mujeres Libres, Free Women. And these sort of oppositional centers coalesced around campaigns to extend and coordinate the revolution, also defend it from encroachments from the state and from police operations, which were becoming an increasing issue as 1937 went on. This all like sort of reaches ahead with the May Days of 1937.
From a sort of the leadership perspective, so like they had made a certain decision about how to work with the other forces on the left in Spain. How did they view these other groups, these sort of splinter groups during this period? Like from an anarchist perspective, from what I understand, they don't have a lot of ideological ground to stand on in terms of, hey, you should follow our choices. So how did they interact with those other groups?
Well, not well in the main, you know. They largely see it as an issue of a sort of a threat to their control. There's lots of sorts of bureaucratic attempts to shut down opposition and declaring like meetings unconstitutional and things like this, attempting to sort of discredit the conclusions that those meetings come to. As the war goes on, particularly after the May Days, you have like attempts to kick out oppositional groups such as the Friends of Durruti. You have the CNT like leadership collaborating in the closure of like oppositional centers around like around the defense committees. Also, even the closure of newspapers. You know, something unheard of. You know, the anarchist leadership actively involving itself in censorship of its own activists. You know, And there are worse, you know, there are some even worse examples. As from their point of view, you know, they felt that having made this commitment to collaboration, any sort of threat to that was effectively threatening the war effort, you know, the broader picture of the war effort. And so that gave like their arguments a kind of moral force and urgency that overrode any ideological scruple that they may have felt. The problem for them was in terms of like having any kind of credibility with the wider anarchist movement was that they hadn't actually, you know, they hadn't succeeded in winning much support for their ideas. You know, they had been incorporated into the structures of government largely to then be sidelined effectively. And, you know, the use of the anarchist leadership as far as the state authorities was concerned was that they would act to discipline their own membership, which is effectively what happened. You know, but the most notable example being during the May Days when there is this mass mobilization on the part of the anarchists, like the middle-ranking anarchist activists and the grassroots against the police and the authorities and particularly the you know, the Stalinist forces in Catalonia, which is then demobilized by the anarchist leadership through bureaucratic maneuvering effectively. So yeah, I mean, in many respects, the anarchist movement is, if not formally, is effectively split but from that point on. You know.
Okay. So you mentioned that the anarchists had joined in with the government, or were collaborating with the government, I should say. So what was their relationship like with the communists or other groups within that government? It was quite strained, from what I understand. How did they sort of coexist in the face of what was a common enemy?
Within government, like there is rivalry between the communists and the CNT. I suppose where the rivalry is most inflamed is actually on the streets in the Republican rear guard, and this is commonly presented as an ideological problem, which I think is misleading. Really, communism with a capital C in Spain was Stalinism, which is to say that it wasn't really an ideology. You know, it's the name given to the politics of counter-revolution in Russia and elsewhere. And in Spain in particular, it's the politics that provides a structure of opportunity for people who are enemies of the CNT, enemies of the revolution, and are personally ambitious. So to give a couple of examples related to Catalonia in particular, in the first months of the Civil War, the CNT's committees had taken charge of food distribution in the city of Barcelona. They famously turned the Ritz Hotel into a popular canteen. When the Generalitat, the regional government of Catalonia, re-established control of this area, the man who was put in charge of food supplies was Joan Comorera, who on the face of it was the chief representative of Catalan communism. So he's the general secretary of the PSUC, which was the Catalan branch of the Third International, the Comintern. But Comorera's policy, right from the get-go, was to reintroduce a free market in food. And this rapidly led to hoarding, rapidly led to shortages, bread queues. But quite aside from the failures of this policy, it's clear that it's not an ideological move. To introduce a free market in food and puts Comorera to the right of Winston Churchill. You know, there's no ideological justification for this. It's not only does it like place him on the right politically, it puts him at odds with the stated communist goal of that particular moment in Spain, right? Of increasing centralization and interest for more coordinated war effort. So you can't make sense of communism in Spain at this time by taking it at face value, right? It only makes sense. I mean, Comorera's policy only makes sense in terms of shoring up support, a support base among shopkeepers and the better off who can afford to buy on the black market. And he's trying to curry resentment and division on the Barcelona street. And that is not something that you can justify according to communist ideology or war aims, right? You can only understand it by trying to understand Stalinism as these slippery politics of counter-revolution and personal ambition. To take another example, Ricardo Burillo is a soldier, a veteran of the colonial wars in Morocco. He's made chief of police in Barcelona after the May Days in 1937. So as chief of police, he's responsible for the arrest of thousands of revolutionaries, anarchists and Marxists. He's responsible for operations that dismantle like centers, working class centers, educational centers, the sack libraries and so forth in Barcelona. And he's personally involved in the scandalous attempt to establish a completely false connection between the Spanish fascists and the anti-Stalinist Marxist Andreu Nin, who Soviet agents had tortured to death in the summer of 1937. So he's personally involved in that. So seemingly a very committed Stalinist. But he's later expelled from the party, and he then takes part at the end of the war in what's known as the Casado coup, right? The infighting that brings the Republican war effort to an end. It's an anti-communist power grab. So it's basically impossible to understand that kind of career trajectory if you understand communism as having an independent meaning as a belief system or a set of loyalties. You can only really understand them as being about personal ambition tied to an absolute overweening commitment to the counter-revolution. And I'm sorry if that's like laboring the point in terms of the question. But it's only to illustrate the fact that as long as anarchism was a revolutionary movement, right? And this is debatable in Spain. You know, it's a revolutionary movement on the one hand, it's also a party of government. But insofar as anarchism remained a revolutionary movement, it could not coexist with communism or with so-called communism in Spain. And not for any ideological reason, not for any like reasons of sectarianism or anything like that. It's because the only uniting characteristic and the overriding priority of Spanish communism was opposition to the revolution. And you know, Stalinism, it's important to acknowledge, was only one aspect of the process by which the revolution was sidelined and then extinguished. And there has been a tradition in a lot of historical writing about the Spanish Civil War, perhaps to overemphasize the role of the communists, you know, to sort of present like the counter-revolution and the process whereby Republican state authority was reconstructed as being a kind of Machiavellian Soviet-inspired plot. And, you know, I don't go along with that, right? But the problem, what gets lost in this debate, or what gets certainly overstated in this debate, regardless of which side you happen to fall on, is the supposed ideological coherence of Spanish communism, which can lead to really ridiculous readings of the internal conflicts that took place in the Republic. So, for example, Eric Hobsbawm, you know, is obviously a famous and in many ways great historian, the late historian, wrote an article in the Guardian newspaper, like going back quite a bit now, in which he said that the internal conflicts of the Republic between anarchists and communists were effectively an echo of the dispute between Marx and Bakunin, which is, you know, is not helpful to understanding the conflicts at all. And these people, you know, that I'm referring to, not necessarily the grassroots of the Communist Party, but their leaders, these people were Marxists, like Donald Trump is a Christian. You know, yeah. And he's literally, you know, comparable.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Yeah, it's interesting to... That seems like a kind of thing where over time, the simplification maybe of the narrative of the Spanish Civil War has actually caused problems in terms of understanding what is actually happening there. Because even I just, you know, oh yeah, they're communists. And then I sort of associate a certain set of ideological beliefs to those people that may not in any way be applicable.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely understandable, really, on the face of it. But it's like one of the tragedies of Stalinism is that it corrupts the meaning of communism and how that might be interpreted or understood. I mean, there's a defendable argument about the right approach to take during the Civil War with regards to questions like centralization and things like that. Coordination, but the you know, things like reintroducing a free market, which you know, was an armed reintroduction, right? It was done a reintroduction of privatization, which was done at the bayonet point, and which involved like street fighting in order to back it up. There's no way that that can be justified according to the supposed priorities of winning the war, and certainly not by any sort of like traditional communist understanding, even in like you know, sort of Leninist variant. You know, you can imagine like suggesting something like that during the period of war communism. I mean, you know, the whole point about Stalinism is that it tries to find, you know, it does these like somersaults to try and find like some kind of textual ideological justification for everything that it does. So that during the Spanish Civil War, it sort of presented its policies as a kind of Spanish NEP. So I don't know if like you and your listeners are familiar with like Russian history, but the NEP being Lenin's new economic policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he brought in from 1921, which reintroduced some elements of a free market into Russian society. But this was done after the Civil War had been won. You know, this like there's no sort of analogy or like comparable basis for introducing what, you know, in effect was a totally counterproductive measure in Spain. And you know, the another sort of the tragic aspect of this, which is like commented on by anarchist participants in this fascinating documentary, which is available online with English subtitles, called Living Utopia, which talks about the anarchist revolution and anarchist experience in Spain during the Civil War. And one of the contributors, you know, who'd been a participant, says that, you know, it's a great paradox that it's difficult for people to appreciate, but there were genuine communist experiments going on, right? Humbling, moving experiments in living in organizing society in an egalitarian way in Spain during the Civil War. And they were destroyed by military units commanded by somebody who called himself a communist, you know. That's just one of the paradoxes of Stalinism. So I don't know. I think I've labored this point long enough, but you know, to me, it's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the distinction there is very important. So switching away from the political side of things, obviously this was a civil war. There was fighting, military units. So on the military side of things, how were anarchist military units organized and led? I know there were regional or local sort of defense committees, but did that extend into the military units who saw service, like, you know, at the front line, maybe even away from their home areas?
Yeah, it's a good and complicated question, and it's possible that my response in some ways will be somewhat limited, and that, you know, there are some people who are more experts in this area than myself, so I'll do my best. The militias were initially organized by these defense committees, which were answerable to the anarchist organizations, primarily the CNT. So the structures of the CNT, as you say, right, which are organized along, like, you know, into local, regional, national committees and so forth, they don't map onto the militia units exactly, in the sense that the militia units replicate those organizational forms. But the militias are, at least to an extent, answerable to the regional organizations of the CNT. So, you know, there's some sort of democratic oversight, if you like. The anarchist militia columns had their own war committees, and there were some elected delegate representation within those war committees, right, from the actual militias themselves. But democratic control over the leadership of the columns was limited. I mean, if you think that, like, you know, a lot of these columns are actually named after their commander, so it would have been a bit awkward, you know, if like they tried to vote Durruti out, and, you know, well, what are we going to call a column? You know, that would be the first like issue to have to face. So there were cases where grievances with commanders were brought before the CNT's regional committees by ordinary soldiers. So, you know, that did happen. So they did have recourse, but I suppose you couldn't just, like, if you felt like a commander was bullying or using their power arbitrarily. I don't know if there was like, I mean, you could feasibly call an assembly, but that wasn't necessarily built into the structures of how the militia operated. You had your immediate recourse was to the regional committee back in the rear guard. But nevertheless, there was a libertarian democratic spirit at work within the militias, which George Orwell famously describes in relation to the Marxist militias that he was involved in. Something broadly comparable is taking place within the anarchist militias, and that it coexists uneasily with the brutal imperatives of war making and questions of discipline and things like that. In terms of the democratic organizing, to try and get back to your question, something that caused resentment among ordinary militia volunteers was the way in which they were effectively excluded from the decision-making processes back in the rear guard. So if you think about it, a lot of the people who went off to fight were people who had already given the best part of their lives to union organizing. They were like very committed. And they suddenly found that those unions that they'd spent so long building up, now had no way of incorporating their voice now that they were at the front. So this was like a kind of anomaly. It was rectified by the libertarian youth organizations, which gave representation to the front, effectively, allowed the front to send delegates to their congresses and things like that. But that it was never, it was given very short shrift by the CNT at a regional and national level when it was raised. And it was raised, in the primary sources, you see it being raised by ordinary CNT members back in the rear guard. And it was raised by this really extraordinary assembly that was called among the anarchist militia units at the beginning of 1937. It had been called by the Iron Column and the Moroto Column, which was, I suppose, a less well-known anarchist column that was dug in Baza, in the north of Granada province in south of Spain. And they called this conference specifically to raise this problem of how their voice could be represented in the rear guard decision-making processes of the CNT. But the CNT's official representative who was there declared it, an unconstitutional meeting, and their concerns were basically brushed aside.
Interesting.
Sorry?
I just said interesting.
Well, it's interesting to me as well, you never know, because you live this kind of dweeby existence being interested in all these aspects of the anarchism response to war. You've no idea really if it's interesting to other people. Mm-hmm. This democratic spirit within the militias was also demonstrated in the opposition to militarization, right, which was the subject of numerous assemblies and conversations that were taking place over the course of months in the actual militia columns and units, particularly with regard to things that were especially resented, the formalization of rank, pay differentials, saluting, all the kinds of things that they felt that weren't only contrary to the spirit of a revolutionary army, but were actually pointless, weren't necessary to as an effective war effort. But all of those decisions that those assemblies came to, and the objections they raised were ultimately disregarded. There was an enormous amount of pressure on to accept militarization. It was ultimately. There's also the phenomenon of militia soldiers returning to the rear guard, which I think has been understudied. There are a few quite famous cases of several hundred people leaving the Durruti column, for example, in opposition to militarization and going back to Barcelona. But I've been finding more and more seemingly isolated cases that amounts to a much bigger picture, I think, of anarchists leaving the front in the beginning of 1937. Not leaving it in the sense of abandoning the fight against fascism, but thinking we need to go back to the rear guard, we need to sort out the political direction of our movement, and then we can get back to fighting what we want to fight, which is a revolutionary war. And that, I think, was an important factor in the process of radicalization of anarchist organizations in the build-up to the May Day's uprising.
So do you think sort of the people at the front, and even, you know, the, as you mentioned earlier, sort of the workers at the bottom of this sort of movement, did they feel like an overall sense of perhaps even betrayal at what was happening or what decisions were being made around them by, you know, people who a few years ago they may have agreed with on a lot of sort of ideological things?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's difficult. It's perhaps difficult to generalize. But there's a definite sense of betrayal around the events of the May Days, because one of the key figures who in the demobilization of the May Days, right, of the process whereby anarchist militants left the barricades when they'd been in a very promising situation in terms of like taking over Barcelona effectively. One of the key figures in that demobilization was Juan García Oliver, who was at that point Minister of Justice in the Republican government, but who had been the key dashing figure of revolutionary insurrectionism in the years prior to the Civil War. So it was a very bitter pill, I think, a very bitter pill for people to swallow, particularly people who had gone into the streets with him in uprisings in, you know, in 1933 and so forth, who looked to him as like a kind of incorruptible figure. You know, when he made these like radio broadcasts over Barcelona radio during the May Days, appealing to all sides to lay aside their arms and completely disregarding any of the kind of political issues that were at work here and any of the reasons that, you know, the anarchists might have had to, you know, to bitterly resent the Stalinist and Catalan nationalist operations that had been taking place, you know, that sparked off the May Days uprising. He completely disregards all that. He says, you know, if I was to like kiss the bodies of those who have fallen in this unfortunate fratricidal battle, I wouldn't know, you know, who to kiss first, you know, the police or my anarchist brothers. You know, people listening to that, you know, there are eyewitness reports of people crying with frustration, people refusing to believe that that García Oliver was speaking freely. You know, they thought was speaking under duress, you know, that someone was holding a gun to his head or something like that. You know, they couldn't really believe it. It was an absolute transformation. And I think in that sense, you know, the comparison that became quite widespread between the May Days and the Kronstadt uprising, which for many, sort of, particularly in the anarchist tradition, marks the end point of the Russian Revolution, that the last chance for salvaging Soviet democracy in 1921. Is particularly apposite, because, you know, the very people who were putting down this rebellion are the same people who had promised so much originally as revolutionary figures. And, you know, the intention of that is not to like personalize it. You know, these people, individuals, are making decisions in extremely tense, difficult circumstances that it's impossible to relate to from, you know, a position of like, you know, being like, you know, suburban Liverpool, it doesn't compare. You know, maybe town on a Saturday night, some like resemblances, but you know, like, there's no way I can really relate to the kind of pressure that individuals like that are under. So it's not to you know, like, just condemn people out of hand for making these decisions in these circumstances. But to try and empathize with, or to try and like reimagine, historically reconstruct what it must have been like for his former comrades to see such a transformation in his whole like behavior, attitude, and to think, you know, this is where the revolution can end up. You know, the whole point of anarchism is to avoid this kind of like status cul-de-sac. You know, it's to give yourself freedom and maneuver. So yes, it was, you know, whether they saw it as a betrayal or whether they saw it as like a tragedy, you know, yeah, it was an extremely depressing situation for a lot of people, and continued to be, you know, for decades afterwards. people struggle to understand it. You know, you can, some of the correspondence has been published between people who were young anarchists at the time, right, and behind the barricades, you know, 16, 17 years old. People like Diego Camacho, who later wrote histories under the pen name of Abel Paz. People like Herman El Gracia, who later wrote under the pen name of Victor Garcia. They both corresponded with García Oliver in the, I think, in the 60s. And trying to understand them, you know, they'd lived with it for 30 years and they still couldn't get their heads around it, you know. It's a fascinating, but in many ways, yeah, you can see why it was such a desperate and sad situation for so many people.
Obviously, the war is not successful for these Spanish anarchists. It does not go well at the end. So what was the fate of anarchism in Spain, you know, immediately after the Civil War had ended?
Well, I mean, those anarchists who remain in Spain face terrible persecution, you know, concentration camps, summary execution. The face of the broader left in Spain. You know, there's heartbreaking stories of anarchist assemblies being held on the beach at Alicante, where thousands of Republicans had gathered, hoping for an exit from Spain, right, which never came, and the boats didn't come. And when that's apparent, when it's apparent that the Italian soldiers are bearing down on them, there are debates, and this is detailed in the fantastic Granada documentary from the 1980s on the Spanish Civil War. The debates take place about what to do, like whether to live to fight another day as prisoners and accept your fate, whatever that may be, or to commit suicide. You know, it's an extraordinary, desperate situation that people found themselves in. And people like Máximo Franco, who was very young, fought at the front, fought at the Maydays as well, you know, already a young age, a veteran of Spanish anarchism. He committed suicide facing the sea. He said, "This is my last protest against fascism." It's extraordinary, and, you know, an extremely bitter fate. Thousands also went into exile. Many Spanish anarchists ended up in the French resistance during the Second World War. And then, you know, many others made a go of keeping the organizations going in the underground. You know, that was a persistent, constant effort right through the 40 years of Franco's dictatorship. And anyone who did that was risking everything. You know, people were arrested, tortured, killed with depressing frequency, and particularly in the early years, and particularly when it became clear that the outcome of the Second World War wasn't going to dislodge Franco from power. You know, there's a brief moment of thawing, or apparent thawing in terms of the state repression. Once it becomes clear that that's not going to last, then, you know, the crackdown is very, very cruel. And yeah, it's a sad story, but one, of course, with many examples of extraordinary tenacity, extraordinary resilience and solidarity. And, you know, in some ways, anarchism is able to subsist. It's obviously very difficult for people to speak openly about anarchism during these years. To do so is to take extraordinary risks. And that's even right up until Franco's death in the mid-70s. I met an anarchist, an extraordinary man, called Carlos Diaz, who lives in Madrid, who is a Catholic anarchist, probably one of the very few Catholic anarchists who ever existed, certainly in Spain. And he told me that in the later years of the Franco dictatorship, he went out on the streets with a friend of his, Juan Gomez Casas, who later became a leader of the CNC and important historian of Spanish anarchism in his own right. And they went out almost like Jehovah's Witnesses. It was like evangelicals, like knocking on people's doors and saying, hello, would you like to talk about anarchism? And, you know, Carlos Diaz was arrested for doing just that, you know. People were taking extraordinary risks in the name of this, of fidelity to this idea, to this idealism, and to this tradition. And that's extremely humbling. But the end result of 40 years of dictatorship and exile was that when, after Franco died, there was a massive resurgence of interest in the anarchist movement, and the CNT is involved in important strikes and is attempting to reconstruct itself as an organization. There is a serious disconnect, a generation gap, because you have these older people who are coming back from exile, these younger people who are coming fresh to the movement, but there isn't really that bridge between those two experiences, because the nature of the repression have been such that that kind of underground educational culture that was required to nurture a generation after the Civil War just didn't exist. And that generation gap proved very difficult to overcome.
Excellent. Okay, thank you for joining me here for this interview. Those were fantastic answers, very interesting as well. So thank you.
Well, thanks very much for having me, a pleasure.
If you would like to read more from Dr. Evans, I've put a link in the show notes to the website where I listed out a lot of the things that I read in preparation for this interview.